toi 8, toi, toi 7, 8, 4, 2, toi.
CKUT, CKUT 90.3 FM.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing.
On.
There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize?
Our consciousness is affected.
There is this thing going on.
What is called?
The news brought to you live.
And welcome to this month's edition of Labor Radio here on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your co-host, Mustafa Hanaway, and always joined with the lovely...
Stefan, I'm happy to be with you again, Mustafa. I think we missed last month.
We did last month, but we both have two kids. That's four kids between us, so...
We're almost outnumbered. Mm-hmm. So anyways, forgive us for that little lapse, but we're coming back strong. We got a really great interview for you this month with James Russell, author of the newly published Labor Guide to Retirement Plans for Labor Organizers and Employees, recently published by Monthly Review. So we were really happy to speak with him about pensions, retirement savings plans, all the whole works,
and also the transition from to this sort of financialized neoliberal model of pensions, and
which Jim aptly says they're not pensions, they're just savings plans. They're basically You go to the bank and you ask them to play with your money, please, and hopefully have a retirement at the end of it. Anyway, there'll be more time to discuss that in the interview, but just wanted to shout that out off the top. So stick around for that. But before we get to that, let's talk a little bit about some labor news in Quebec generally.
Yeah, because I think we're kind of sitting on a moment that we haven't seen in a long time. And a lot of us have been talking about it, that there's, you know, sort of the strike wave and the post-pandemic, but also now compounded with the crisis that we're beginning to see in terms of, you know, both inflation, kind of how employers are reacting to union drives right now and certain struggles. So it truly is a, I think, a unique moment in our local, like in Quebec.
For sure. I mean, when we were talking just before the show, I think we were, I mean, we do this every month. We sort of go over the last month's worth of strikes and other labor activity. This time, it just seems kind of impossible to make a bilan, like a look back on the last month, because there's so many strikes from the northern tip of the of the province at the mine in Raglan mine, I think it's called, all the way to Amazon here on the South Shore. You know, there's strikes happening every single day, all over the place, public, private, you name it. So something's definitely happening.
No. And we're living in a moment, you know, recently some statistics came out, right? Where corporate profits, you know, during this period of inflation have gone up like 20%. But, you know, inflation is 8% and wages have only risen 6%. So the idea that like, that it's workers' fault, you know, that that this is, you know, that it's the sort of the price wage spiral or whatever they call it. And it's a completely different context, right? And so I think it's one where workers didn't cause the inflationary cycle, but workers now having to react. And a lot of this, you know, and more discussion too about how this is essentially monopolies gouging, right? Like even the Democrats in the U.S. are like having to admit, like, there's just, it's monopolies just setting the prices now.
Yeah. Yeah. And lots of things are still off the table in terms of politics as usual. So there's no mention of price controls, and there's no, virtually no like serious talk of sort of windfall taxes and sort of, basically taking power out of the hands of monopolies. They're just trying to, like, I mean, from Legault telling us he'll give us $500 to, you know, all the rest of it. Everyone at the top is trying to tell us that we have to pay for it. Yeah.
No. And then there's the little $500 bonus while certain corporations are walking away with, you know, being able to set the prices at double, you know, like if you look at the oil industry or you look at agribusiness, it's wild. And you know, and I guess like for workers are going to organize, but it's like, where do we, you know, how do we intervene as well? What do we demand? And
yeah. And you can see that because largely I think the private sector in Canada and Quebec has been the most sort of timid for a certain number of years, like with deindustrialization and so on. Workers have been kind of shy to ask for higher wages and not just maintaining what they already have. But you're already seeing like the Molson agreement. There was certain job classifications that were getting like 40-50% higher wages, really incredible numbers for the private sector. And so I think that like this can be, well, it will be decisive either way, you know, whether the organized working class can walk away with this in a better position, bargaining harder and so on, versus sort of taking it lying down and being made to do exactly what the employers want, which is pay for the crisis that they had no hand in setting up.
No, and I mean now, and I mean the private sector, you know, that anger, you know, we're seeing that conflict take place, right? Like, you know, in one story, I mean, we have the Amazon organizing, and where part of it now is about wages, right? Being on par with the rest of the warehouse sector, and the Montreal Amazon Workers Union, which is supported by CSN, you know, and the union activists were being, you know, harassed by management, outside management and intervened by Amazon, isolating union activists, you know, also Amazon began putting up all of these signs, you know, you have the right to vote no to a union, you have the right to not sign a card. But, you know, CSN intervened, sent letters. So it's a very public campaign, and there's now this, you know, confrontation that's taking place inside, right, between workers and management, but management has like backed down, right? And so, you know, I mean, it's only one example, right, where they're not actually going on strike, but they're organizing. But, you know, what we saw in IKEA last week, too, you know, is an example of that anger.
Yeah, tell us about IKEA, because you actually went there.
At IKEA, it's a CSN, it's organized by CSN, and it's one of its large private sector locals, you know, low wages, hardworking conditions. And was it last week or 2 weeks ago? You know, workers had what was an impromptu strike, literally walked out on the shift. And you know, it's rare that you kind of see that level of anger, right, that you're seeing now. You know, workers just feeling the power to just walk out of a workplace, you know. And so there's a high degree of militancy inside IKEA, which is incredible to see.
Absolutely. Well, and maybe one more conflict to touch on, and that's directly related to this interview that we're about to listen to, is the Rolls-Royce conflict in the West Island. So I think they repair like airplane engines or something like that. They recently switched to CSN. They were with an international union. And they went into a strike vote with basically no money in their strike fund because the international union took off with it. But they were locked out immediately while they were in a general assembly. And this conflict is largely over pensions. So now they're entering, as of yesterday, 3 months of lockout. And like again, with sort of like no time to financially prepare for this type of drawn out conflict. I mean, these are people who make good wages, but now they've been without those good wages for 3 months. And like I said, no strike fund to speak of. So they're doing benefits, they got GoFundMes going. They've been targeted but with injunctions. They've complied with the injunctions and then been charged with breaching the injunction, even though they didn't. There's been strike breakers brought in that the Rolls-Royce has admitted to having done, which is against the law. So anyways, very intense conflict. And I mean, no real end in sight. This is sort of like top shelf private sector viciousness, if I can say so.
No, it's really one of those, this is really out to crush or attempt to crush the union, and I guess solidarity is really really needed, and because it's sort of out of sight, it's kind of one of those struggles where, you don't see there's not the immediate effect, you know, it's not like ports, it's not like a General Auto plant, but it's really like a signal to workers.
No doubt. Well, maybe on that note, let's go have a musical break. On the other end, you'll hear our conversation with Jim Russell, author of Labor Guide to Retirement Plans. So enjoy the interview. As always, thanks for listening to Labor Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM. We're here every third Thursday of the month from 5 to 6 p.m. And you can always find us also on Facebook and Mixcloud, where you can listen back to old episodes and share our content with those you think should be listening to us.
Yeah, and stay tuned to the rest of our show here on Labor Radio.
Cool. We'll be right back. Hello and welcome back to Labor Radio here on CKUT 90.5 FM. We're happy to have a nice long discussion today with James W. Russell, author of the new book, The Labor Guide to Retirement Plans for Union Organizers and Employees, published by Monthly Review Press out of New York. Got a chance to read this book over the last couple months. Really happy to have you on the show, James, retired professor of sociology and still a writer, still active on the question of pension plans, retirement plans, and so on. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So let's start with, you know, one of my favorite things about this book, and when I started reading it, it wasn't long, it's in the introduction, but I had to interrupt my girlfriend and share with her this passage from the introduction. So this, I think, will sort of set the tone for our discussion here. And I'm just going to read this for our audience. In this book, I will share with you what I've learned from years of study of retirement and retirement activism. I'll present the material in an understandable a manner as possible. In many cases, it took me a great deal of time to understand an issue because no one else had explained it well, perhaps because they did not understand themselves. Writing can be annoying when you suspect the writer is trying to hide a lack of understanding by not clearly explaining a critical concept or idea. I hope not to be guilty of that type of incomplete or lazy writing in the pages to come. I've made sure that I understand what I'm writing about so that I can explain it well. So I think like that should be copy pasted into every introduction to every book, but that's not the case. We'll work with what we have. So why did you write this book? Why did you feel that you had to, in what you just described, like sort of explain something that's not very well understood and explain it so well and understand it so well? What took you to the place where this book came to be?
Well, there were two roads into it. One is that I study social policy in general, and a subset of that is retirement plans. And when I was studying that, I saw a ranking of retirement types of retirement plans according to which were most favorable to workers. And I discovered that the one that I was in was the least favorable to workers. And that was a what's called in the US a 401k plan or a defined contribution plan, okay, where you basically put money into the stock market and hope that it will gain enough to support your retirement. Well, what then happened was that 2008 occurred, okay, in which the bottom dropped out of the stock market. And at my university, those of us in that plan were in a huge panic as to what would happen. And I wasn't that far away from retirement myself. And so out of that came a movement in the state of Connecticut to allow us to take our money in these accounts and roll them into a regular pension plan. And everybody said we were crazy. You couldn't do that. It was probably illegal. Okay, well, 4 or 5 years later, we won that battle. And it was one of the few victories like that in the US because almost everything is going the other way. I might just, for the point of clarity here, I think there's a lot of confusion in how people use the term pension plan. There are some people who say pension plan is any retirement plan. I think that that's very incorrect because a pension plan is a collective plan where there is risk sharing among the members, where there is a guaranteed benefit. And that's very different from these saving and investment schemes like the, you know, the one in Canada, the Registered Retirement Savings Plan, or which is similar to the 401k in the United States. Those have no guarantees with them. There's no risk sharing among members. So I don't refer to them as pension plans, although some people do.
Right. And I was wanting to bring that story in because I think it like helps frame the discussion. So you beat me to it. But before we go too much into the different types of retirement plans, I think like in the beginning of the book, you kind of do like a brief history of retirement plans. And maybe you focus on Social Security in the States to a certain degree. We have something similar in Canada, Canada Pension Plan, or in Quebec here. It's the Régime des Rentes Québec. But basically the public pension system. But you also talk about sort of the neoliberal turn and the privatization of these plans and so on. Can you talk about like, or can you give us like a brief history as you do in the book of like the idea of retirement plans even? Like obviously this didn't come out of thin air.
Yeah, I mean, it starts in the 1880s in Germany. Okay, with Tetzer Bismarck, who for very conservative motives wants to take away the appeal of the rising Social Democratic Party. And so he thinks that if he is able to have a type of pension plan that will win the loyalty of German workers to the German state, because they'll have something that's worth preserving in the state. And, you know, I don't want to say it's Bismarck per se, it's his advisors and so forth who come up with this idea of creating a type of pension plan that's publicly financed, or social insurance is the more technical term. And that has been in existence ever since. Okay. I mean, all the way through, you know, the 30s, all the way through the fascist period, all the way through the communist period. Okay, these pension plans, if they're managed correctly, can go on forever. Okay, which is one of the erroneous beliefs a lot of people have, is that they're just not feasible in the long term. But if you look at the German plan, it's been going on since the 1880s. Well, very quickly, other countries followed suit. And then in the U.S., you get it in 1935 with the Social Security Act. You get it somewhat later in Canada, okay, the development of these types of plans. And so they're almost universal around the world. But then in the 1970s, you begin to see a neoliberal attempt to transform these from public plans to private plans. And the most spectacular example of that is Chile under the Pinochet dictatorship, in which in one fell swoop, they transformed a public social security system into a privatized investment and savings scheme. And that's, at first, I think most people didn't really know what to make of that, whether it would work, whether it would not work. But by 2000, the year 2000, it was very clear in Chile that it was failing tremendously. Okay, and Chileans have gone to the streets in the hundreds of thousands to demonstrate against that retirement system. And with the new progressive president of Chile, that will definitely be one of the main issues to be addressed, whether they can reverse that privatization. There was an attempt in the US in 2005 that didn't make it.
Right, so in terms of your book, you talk about, it's sort of broken into sections, largely like the, what we can really call a pension, you know, like, the Social Security in the States, were the pension, the public pension plans, basically the employer-sponsored, defined benefit plans, and maybe you can explain what those are, and then also the retirement savings accounts, essentially, and then finally there's also just the concept of saving money in a bank account. But you talk about the three-legged stool of retirement plans. Can you explain this concept and break down these different categories?
Yeah, I mean, the three-legged stool was more an analogy to the United States. I think for Canada, it's a four-legged stool. Okay, it has the Canadian pension plan and then the old age security. And so you have the public part of it is divided into two parts. In the US, it's one part. And so the idea was that for people to have retirement security, they had three legs of it, like a stool. Okay, one was Social Security in the US. The second was a pension from their work. And third was their own savings. Okay, well, this was always a myth to begin with. First off, if you look at the statistics of this, very few people have savings. So the third leg really doesn't exist in the US. And it started out that in the 1930s, the idea was that the Social Security and an employer pension plan would form two equal legs. Okay, that never happened. That is to say that the Social Security system became the main source of income for most people in the United States. And the second leg of the employer pension plans is being steadily whittled down. And the biggest way it got whittled down was the transformation beginning in the 1980s from defined benefit pensions to these savings plans or 401ks. And that was a massive transformation beginning in the 1980s. I mean, if you were, if you took the year 1980, okay, first off, about half of people in the United States had no retirement plan other than Social Security. So we have to start with that. I mean, it wasn't exactly a golden age. Okay, but if you had a retirement plan, it was, 70% or more of them were defined benefit plans. That was the predominant plan. Okay, if you look at it now, it's very parallel to what has happened in Canada. Okay, is that those guaranteed defined benefit plans have become less and less, and these retirement savings plans have become more and more. And that's been the great transformation in retirement. And at the same time, the amount of money that people are getting is much less. Okay. And that's the part that I don't know that there's a tremendous amount of clarity about, the same type of clarity that the Chileans have.
I have one question, Jim, and that is, for the Canadian listener, I mean, there's, for those who are dependent on Social Security as the primary source of income during retirement, how much is that in the United States? Is that a living wage? Is that even nowhere remotely close towards a living wage? Can people survive on it? What is it like for those who are simply on social assistance?
Well, it's actually similar to what people get in Canada. I was looking this up yesterday. If you take the two sources of public, the old age security and the Canadian pension plan and combine them, it's similar to what the average get on Social Security in the United States. That's not enough. I mean, it's clearly not enough. And any reform of the system has to address the amount of money that people get from it. I mean, the system and systems like it work well in the way that they're structured. Okay, but you have to put more into them if you want to get more out of them.
Maybe I want to come back to the defined benefit plans, because I think there's some questions like, you know, our show is called Labor Radio. The book talks about union organizers in the title. I think there's some really valuable insights and tips that you bring out in the book in terms of contract negotiations and some of the key battles that can be fought within a collective bargaining process. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, one of the, like, your conclusion to your book and sort of towards what Mustafa was talking about, you really advocate for the universal public option as being the sort of the long-term solution to the, like, old age poverty and to sort of like dignity in retirement, I guess, for working class people. Can you sort of explain that argument and counterpose it to like the other visions that are being proposed to people right now under these different regimes?
Yeah, I mean, there are basically two approaches to this. One is the traditional pension, okay, which I was explaining before, is a collective agreement that has guaranteed benefits to it, that has risk sharing, that minimizes the amount of drainage to fees and profits and so forth, and keeps as much of it dedicated to providing income for retirees. That's one approach. The other approach is the stock market investing that's done on an individual basis. Now, it's probably no surprise to listeners to this program that one of those is much more profitable for the financial services industry, and that's the second one, the investment approach. So of course, they would love to privatize all of the public pension plans to roll that money into something that they can play with. But if you're looking purely at the question, what is the most efficient way to deliver the most amount of income to retirees? It's through collective plans. And you can demonstrate that any way you want. Okay, even though a lot of people think that they're going to get rich on the stock market. Okay, but if you look at the statistics of it, it's just not happening. Okay. I mean, you know, I mean, I one of the chapters in the book is called Autopsy of a Retirement Plan. Okay, I was in one of these things for 35 years. And obsessively, I kept all of my, papers from the retirement companies, so I could trace how much my account had accumulated. And I had put in a lot of savings into it, so you couldn't fault me for not saving enough. And I actually did a pretty good job in terms of investment returns, but I still came up really short on this. Okay, nowhere near what I would have gotten if during that period of time I had been in a regular pension plan. Okay, that's the issue that most people have to deal with. So getting to the question of what's the long-term solution, the long-term solution is collective pension plan. Okay, now, if you look at collective pension plans right now, even those who are still lucky enough to have, you know, employer pension plans, they have two sources of income, the public pension plan and their employer pension plan. Okay, it's much more efficient to just have one source, because that creates something that's very portable. And that's one of the problems. When you're dependent on a pension plan from a single employer, what happens if you change jobs? You know, you're inevitably going to lose money. Okay, but if you combine all of the different retirement plans into expanding the Social Security plan of the country, you come up with something like Austria has, which is a single unitary system. And it's very efficient, and it delivers good income to people. So that's why I make that argument that in the long term, we should be phasing out employer plans. Okay, but in the short term, we should fight like Dickens to, you know, keep the best of those plants.
Well, let's talk a bit then about those plans. I feel like there's a few, even like, I mean, I read this book, I finished reading it probably about a month ago now. But a few things really stuck with me when you're talking about the contract negotiations and what labor negotiators should be looking out for, like cost of living adjustments, mm-hmm. The option to like buy credits for years where you weren't working and so on. Can you talk about some of these things just for our listeners who are in labor and maybe give them a taste of what they can get out of reading the book, I guess.
Okay. Well, one thing that I've learned is that almost every plan is different. I mean, it has its own wrinkle to it, which is why it then seems terribly complicated to a lot of people. But there are broad types, you know, defined benefit, defined contribution. Okay, those are broad types. Okay, but within defined benefit plans, there are a lot of differences. Okay, and there are even differences in defined contribution plans. And so what anybody who's in a union that's looking at the issue of retirement plans, you have to really know the plan you got. I mean, you really have to study it and then look at where it's possible to make reforms. And any plan can be reformed for the better. Okay, it doesn't have to all be defensive of what we were talking about before, of just defending what you have. There are a lot of reforms that you can make, and they don't necessarily cost more money. It's just a question of making it something more efficient, okay, or something more convenient for job changers, for example. Question of being able to buy credits in the plan, because you can actuarially work that out so that it's revenue neutral to the plan. So you really have to become totally fixated on what the plan is and what can be done with the plan. Okay, and then if it turns out it's a really lousy plan, then you have to try to figure out how to get a different type of plan.
One question, Jim, about this sort of this great transformation and then the profits of the financial sector, especially financial services sector, in terms of this, how big or important of a role you think this financialization of retirement plans or pension plans have played in that broader process of financialization?
I mean, I think it's tremendous. I mean, if you go back to 1980, the financial services sector, you know, it had a prominent role, but nowhere near the role that it has today. And I think that a large part of its power came from the expropriation of pension plans so that they had more direct control over this money. I mean, it's a kind of crazy system if you think about it. I mean, you give money to somebody for 30 years or so while you're working on this belief, okay, that at the end of 30 years, when you retire, they'll return the money and it'll be bigger. Okay, all throughout those 30 years, they're in control of the money. I mean, you're the nominal owner of it, okay, but they're the ones who get to use it, you know, in all these different kinds of ways. And if you think that you've got the freedom of investment and choice, you may, but you're going up against professionals, investors, and so you're not likely to come out on a winning side of that. So there's just an enormous drainage. Anyone who's in one of these accounts loses minimally 20% of you know, what they would have had otherwise. That's minimally. Okay. I mean, if they're really in a disadvantageous position, they can lose up to half of what they put into these things. So this drain, you know, which then goes into the financial services industry, has helped to inflate their power. I mean, look at the salaries of the CEOs of those things. I mean, they're in the tens of millions of dollars because they're sitting on these huge pots of worker savings, and they're able to skim off of it. I mean, that's just sort of the beginning of it. Okay, you know, I mean, I think actually a bigger source of loss than that is the lack of risk sharing that goes on. I mean, the example I like to use is if, let's say you put money into the Canadian pension plan, you know, all the way up to age 65, okay, and then you drop dead. Okay, what happens to that money? Okay, it stays within the plan. Okay, it doesn't go to your heirs, or at least I don't think so in Canada. Okay, it doesn't go to your heirs, it stays there. So it means that somebody who lives to be 101 can continue to keep getting a salary because they have the person who dies early is subsidizing their income for, you know, living a long time. It's a good example of the collective ethic here.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if this is outside the scope of your book to a degree, but like definitely there's been controversies here in Quebec, particularly because there's different pension plans, even some that are or investment companies that are even tied to unions and so on, that are involved in, you know, very exploitive projects, whether it's here in Quebec or even in Haiti or whatever. So there's definitely like a big problem with like just financial services and the Imperial Corps and probably elsewhere as well. But where, you know, is it easy? Is it possible to like make an ethical buck on the financial markets, which will then subsidize the pensions of workers? That's a whole, you don't get into that question, and it's probably right. Fair enough, because that's sort of outside the scope of what you're trying to do. But I think it's an interesting discussion to have, certainly. And one that workers probably and unions and sort of like the bigger structures need to be having those discussions. We have about 5 minutes left, and Mustafa, feel free to jump in because I've been asking most of the questions here. I wanted to hear you speak like maybe just a bit like about where you see the future of because, you know, people are talking right now about like strike waves, about like union unionization drives. There's definitely like a sort of uptick in labor militancy. And like we were talking before the show, this is kind of like pensions are not exactly like the hot topic when we're talking on the left or even to a degree in labor. But there's such a crucial part of like some of these big struggles, like the Co-op refinery in Regina, the Rolls-Royce lockout right now in Montreal. So where do you see the next few years going? Do you see a trend emerging? What do you think is going to happen regarding pensions? I mean, you can talk about the U.S. like because that's probably the context that you know better, but I'm sure it has an effect on us as well. It usually does.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'll have to talk about the U.S. That in the U.S. We have the issue of Social Security, which is never off the table. Okay, I mean, it may be quiet for a while, but because they have not properly funded it, it's going to have to reduce benefits in the year 2034, okay, unless they do something to raise revenue for it. And so you have this struggle between the Republicans, who want to solve the problem by reducing benefits, and the Democrats who want to solve the problem by increasing revenues to Social Security. And so that's coming up pretty quickly on us. Then we continually have the problem of people who have traditional pensions, of employers trying to take them away. And you have two locations of that. And here, I think there's a straight parallel with Canada. One is the private sector employers who for whom they've already reduced it, okay, but there still are pension plans that are still out there in there. And then the public sector is where most of the surviving pension plans are. Most people in the public sector still have traditional pension plans. And there are right-wing think tanks that are spending enormous amount of effort to convince the public that these public pension plans are bankrupting taxpayers, okay, and so that they need to get rid of them. And you have, I don't know, I mean, you have a lot of people who spent a whole career, you know, where they've paid to have this benefit when they retire, that now feel guilty about having it, because they've also bought into this notion that somehow having a pension, there's something wrong with it. No, there's nothing wrong with it. In fact, having a pension is in a lot of cases cheaper for employers, okay, but you would never know it from the type of propaganda that's being put out by these think tanks. So that's kind of the framework that I see things you know, going on in the next years. And it's really important that union activists be totally aware of what's going on so that they can, you know, really do a good job of leading with the people they work with.
Well, that's a great note to end on, I think. Thanks so much, Jim, for your time and your expertise.
And I'm sure welcome that back I'm not the to only one who's going to be reading this edition of Labor Radio here on CKT 90.3 FM. And
we got some work to do. So again, thanks for your time.
Discussion with James Russell.
It's been a pleasure talking with you.
On pensions.
Yeah, thanks. It's been great.
Capitalism, to the role of unions and what workers should be demanding. You know, Stefan Doucette, you can also read more on his article, which is on MR Monthly Review Online now, but also on the website.
It's not on the website, but in the newspaper People's Voice, yeah. Originally published there, and then the Monthly Review's putting it up on their website. But yeah, a great book, like definitely, I think, a reference for labor organizers for years to come. You know, it's really sort of makes this kind of boring, complicated subject accessible to regular people like me. I was able to understand the way that labor, that the retirement plans work, sort of what's the best deal for workers and so on. So really invaluable resource for people negotiating and people curious about their own pension plans and so on.
And also, we're the generation without a real pension plan, right?
No, like, don't.
So,
for real. So, thanks for listening. Happy to have you here with us on 90.3 FM on CKUT. We're here every third Thursday of the month from 5 to 6 p.m., giving you news about the working people, organized and not organized. That's what we're trying to provide for you listeners every month.
Yeah, so stay tuned next on next month's edition. Hopefully we'll talk about more in depth about some of the struggles here and some of the burning issues like the inflation crisis that we're all facing now. So stay tuned for next month's edition of Labor Radio.
Thanks for listening.
5:57 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time Thursday, Environment Canada has issued a severe thunderstorm warning for southwestern Quebec. Extra care and attention should be exercised in and around the following localities: Saint-Jean, Lacolle, Saint-Rémy, Huntingdon, and Hemingford. Environment Canada meteorologists are tracking a very dangerous thunderstorm capable of producing destructive wind gusts, baseball size or greater hail and heavy rain. Take cover immediately if threatening weather approaches. Intense lightning is likely, and tornadoes are possible with any thunderstorm that develops.
17h57 heure avancée de l'Est le jeudi, Environnement Canada a émis une alerte d'orage violent pour le sud-ouest du Québec. Une attention et des précautions additionnelles devraient être exercées près et autour des localités suivantes: Saint-Jean, Lacolle, Saint-Rémy, Huntingdon et Hemingford. Les météorologues d'Environnement Canada surveillent un orage très dangereux pouvant produire des rafales destructrices, de la grêle de la taille d'une balle de baseball, ou plus, et de la pluie forte. Mettez-vous immédiatement à l'abri si un phénomène météorologique menaçant s'approche. De nombreux éclairs sont probables, et il y a toujours un risque de tornade avec un orage.
Sunday, June 19th. For more information, visit muralfestival.com.
All right. Directions on how to use your radio. Find the power button. Turn it to on. Turn the knob to CKUT 90.3 FM. Relax and enjoy.
Good Good evening. It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio. From drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. Professional, student, and community productions in and around Montreal, also known as Chuchage and Munayang, where we spell theater with an R-E at the end. I'm your host, Sarah DeA, recording from home on Thursday, June 16th, 2022. On tonight's show, At the Fringe, Ira Cooper on searching for validation as Mr. Coffeehead.
We're alive and existing. That's pretty amazing. That's pretty awesome that we get this opportunity to be here. Like art and cycling, it's really about focusing on not how far you can get on the road, not how done you can get with the painting, but actually painting itself, the very road itself.
Oliver Kumsatira writes about youth violence in his new solo show, Psycho 6 at the Mai.
What makes it that one good kid growing up in a neighborhood, maybe a little bit impoverished, what makes it that one good kid can get intertwined and do something as bad, as lethal, as